Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Ruler podcast for issue number 60. I'm Ian Parkinson. I'm at the Ruler offices in London, and I'm joined by Ruler managing editor Andy McGrath. Now, Ian Cleverly is just back from a few days of checking out the training camps at Calpe in Spain, swanning around effectively. And the plan was for me to basically gently moan and poke fun at Ian Cleverly today for swanning around in the sunshine and sitting in hot tubs while the rest of us were suffering through a British winter. But first of all, he's not here. And secondly, we heard the horrible news from Calpe at the weekend of the crash involving the Giant Alpecin team. Well, what we know of the incident at the moment, and we don't know the full details, is that the riders were apparently in pairs on the correct side of the road when they were hit by a car coming in the other direction. John Degenkolb, Fredrik Ludvigsson, Chad Hauger, Ramon Sinkeldam, Warren Bargill and Max Walscheid all been treated for injuries. Some of them have had surgery, a range of injuries. Thankfully, from what we know from the team sources, none of them are life-threatening or, we think, long-term serious. But it's still a horrific thing to happen, and we can only wish them all the speediest of recoveries. Andy, you've been to Calpe a few times yourself. In fact, sort of going to the early season training camps is a bit of a routine for you.
That's right, yeah. Well, I've been the one swanning around. I was just in Benidorm yesterday with the Spanish Kai Rural team. It's now a pilgrimage place for most of the World Tour teams. It's either going to be Mallorca or Calpe, and if you're very lucky, it'll be South Africa or even Australia. And they take over hotels, basically, because these tourist meccas become ghost towns in winter, so they get really cheap prices. The hoteliers are kind of happy to have them, and they get a bit of sunshine. I can't think of the last time there was a training incident of this gravity in recent years, though, but it is always a kind of occupational hazard, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction, first of all, obviously was shock and then actually surprise, because I've ridden a lot in Spain and it's always struck me as one of the safest places in Europe to be a cyclist. Actually, Spanish drivers are largely very considerate towards riders. One of the awful things is, and again, we don't know the details at all, but one of the awful things is the suggestion that it actually may have been a British driver involved, which just adds another layer of awfulness to the situation. But generally, the weekend's events notwithstanding, Calpe is a great place to be a cyclist.
It is. It's fantastic. You've got the sea and the flatlands and the beach and the iconic Rock of Calpe. I think it's a Rock of Ifac or something like that. And every year I say I'll find a morning to actually go up it and climb it. Never do, though.
But these early season training camps are a sort of strange phenomenon, aren't they? They really have become hugely popular.
With all cyclists, yeah, absolutely. I guess that's the way it's been going the last 10 years with low budget airlines and even the growth slightly of the cycling media kind of promoting this. And now it's a done thing. Like, if you're a British cyclist and you're stuck riding in the lanes in the rain while your mate might be on Facebook posting photos from Lanzarote or something like that, you're the odd one out.
I feel like the odd one out at the moment. One thing that didn't catch on, if you remember a couple of years ago, was that Bjarne Riis, I think, got the Danish SAS in or something for one of his early season training camps, and the riders were jumping off cliffs and swimming in freezing cold water and living in the wilderness. That never really caught on, did it?
It didn't. I'm not sure what it did. I remember CSC always had some decent early season results back in the day. I think Quickstep did an army training course about 2 years ago, running around with guns and like going through obstacle courses blindfolded. But they just kind of won the same amount as I had anyway.
So you may as well just ride around in the sunshine.
Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Issue 60 has the second part of the interview with Jan Ullrich. The first part was in issue 59. And one of the early season rituals in past years was always waiting for Jan Ullrich to turn up looking like a Michelin man at the training camp. But that doesn't happen anymore, does it? You didn't see any significantly overweight riders in Benidorm or Calpe.
There's fat and there's cyclist fat. There are some riders who put on too much weight over the winter, but even then, it's nothing that would really stand out. At worst, you'd call them stocky. With these days, nutritionists and coaches, there's an even keener eye being kept on all that.
One of the people Ian cleverly bumped into out in Calpe was Sean Kelly. He was out there with Chain Reaction and Post. And I'm not sure what his role is with the team. Do you know what it is? He's not the DS or anything, is he?
He isn't the DS. I think it's a kind of between a general manager, but he's not that either, and an ambassador. But he's been doing it for, I think, over 10 years since the team's fledgling days. And it's nice to see him putting something back into Irish cycling. And he always seems to be there in the hotel in a tracksuit. I think he goes riding with the team sometimes, and he's obviously still pretty strong.
As I said, Ian was talking to him, and he said that going to somewhere like Calpe for a pre-season camp was important to teams like his.
It's certainly, you know, good for motivation for the riders, because when you see the big teams and you have some pro tour teams here, I think the guys, when they see that, hopefully it helps, you know, to make them realise that if you work really hard, you're focused, you're 100% committed, who knows, maybe some of those guys in our team can move on to Continental Pro or possibly Pro Tour. So that alone, it's important, you know, that the riders see that. And then, of course, the training camps are always important to get ready for the new season, get the riders to know each other. And now, of course, you know, training camps, a Continental team having two training camps, one in December past, now in January. If you talk 10 years ago, something never happened, but that's the way cycling, I think, everything is ramping up in different ways, and certainly the training camps, they are one thing which are ramping up, because even club teams are coming out to the sunshine and to do some good miles and some good training.
How many years has the team been running now?
Well, it all started with the academy. We had the Sean Kelly Academy House in Belgium, which was set up by Cycling Ireland. They wanted to have a house somewhere in Europe, like the Australians had been doing for many years, and they had a place in Italy. So Cycling Ireland decided that they wanted to do that. They approached me. They were talking about France, and I said, well, France is a big country. Travel to races, it takes a long time. It's a big cost. Go to Belgium. You have so many races for all levels. And they decided to set up a house in Belgium, and it started from there. We had the academy, which was going very well for a number of years, and then Colt decided that he wanted to do a continental team for the Irish riders who were at a level that needed to race more out of Belgium and to go to France and do some races in Spain, and that's how the team came about.
The Irish element is obviously still very strong. I mean, I don't know what is it about 50% Irish rider, something like that? It's obviously a big element of it, but it's not the be-all and end-all, is it?
Well, the Irish element was the reason we started the Continental team, because we felt that there was a need there for a Continental team to look after young, talented Irish riders coming through, take them for 1, 2, possibly 3 years, and then hopefully that they would be able to get the results to move on to Continental Pro and Pro Tour. The Irish end of it was always important, and it still is, and you know, we always try, because we are, you know, very heavily sponsored by, you know, by Irish companies. You know, our main sponsor is Post, Chain Reaction, which is an Irish company. We really try and turn the riders up to the next level, move them on to the next level. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for a number of years. We moved on a lot of riders, but not Irish. But I think of recent, we've moved on Sam Bennett, and now we've moved on Ryan Mullen. So that's, you know, been a success, and we try and do that with, you know, some more riders, Irish riders, in the coming years.
And in that kind of the process of looking at riders for the next year, you know, what is the process? Is it a matter of kind of like digging them out, or, you know, are people making suggestions to you?
Well, you always get the people making suggestions, and, you know, there's always riders from an area who, there's people there, they always push to try and get a rider into a team, like a post-chain reaction team. But Cork is at the races. He, you know, he does some races in Ireland. He does a lot of races in Europe with these younger guys. So he see those guys. He also does, you know, the under-23 races with Cycling Ireland and Cup of Nations, World Championships. So he's there and he sees all the guys, not only from Ireland but also from other countries. So he's in a perfect position, you know, to look at riders and see who we can take in the team, who will suit the team. But yeah. Irish riders, we're always looking for, you know, at least 4 or 5 Irish riders in the team.
If this was football, you'd be moving those guys on, and you'd have £500,000 in your pocket. Surely there should be a transfer system, yes?
Well, I've said it to the UCI 5 years ago, plus 5 years ago, and there's no movement. You know, for the moment, it doesn't look like there's going to anything happening in the near future. But I think for a continental team, I think for cycling, it's important that you have a good structure, continental team-wise, and that would help, you know, to develop riders and take them in the right way and develop with them, work with them. But unfortunately, yes, you know, there isn't a transfer fee. But, you know, with our own team, you know, it's just something we feel that it's a service we give for Irish riders, but also for other riders, that a good continental setup, and hopefully you can, you know, move riders along. Cork also have the ambition also to go to the next level, continental pro. We've been, you know, thinking about that. We've talked about it a bit with potential sponsors in the last 2 or 3 years, and it's always an objective more so for Cork.
Budget-wise, that's a big step up, I imagine.
It's a very big step up,
yeah.
And unless you have, you know, the sufficient budget, because we've had discussions with potential sponsors, but yeah, the budget wasn't sufficient for us to make that move. We would prefer to stay continental at a good level, have a good continental team, to have a bad continental pro team.
Thanks, Sean. All the best to the team for the season.
Thank you very much.
So that's Sean Kelly there from Chain Reaction and Post. And there were also some women's teams out there, and Ian caught up with a couple of riders from Liv Plantur. I hadn't realised until now that Liv Plantur is effectively the female version of Giant Alpecin, because Liv is a women's brand from Giant and Plantur is the women's version of Alpecin shampoo. It's not that many Pro Tour sponsors that actually do that, support a women's team, is there?
No, there's not. I was going to say, there's even fewer that have a different name for the team. That's a funny one, isn't it? You'd think a lot of them would have 300,000 odd euros, maybe slightly more than that, to run a women's programme. But hey, it's not in the rules. There's no obligation.
There's no obligation to do it, no. But it's good that Giant Alpecin, Liv Plantur have done that, because it's clear that that investment in women's cycling is paying off, because they are getting the attention. So Ian spoke to a couple of riders, Leah Kirchman from Canada and the British rider Molly Weaver. You've met Molly, haven't you?
Yeah, I met her before the British National Championships last summer. I think she'd just been second in the TT. And she'd just signed for Liv Plantur. Weaver's tale is fantastic. She was a junior hockey player on the fringes of the England squad as a teenager. And then I think she busted her knee and moved on to cycling. And she tells a story about barely being able to get up the small hill in her village. And now she's rapidly progressed into, well, the World Tour scene. And she could be riding the Olympic road race. She's a pretty good climber. But it's a really impressive transformation.
Let's take a listen to Leah Kirchman and Molly Weaver.
This is our 9th day? 10th day?
Last count.
Yeah, you start to lose track, but I think 9th day, yeah.
And the leg's feeling like it's the 10th day now.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is actually the day after the rest day. It's always, you always feel worse than you think after the rest day.
Molly was telling me earlier that you were a team time trial training today. How did that go?
It was good. I think we were making really good progress as a team, and we're getting smoother every time we ride together. But there was definitely some good suffering in training today.
People tell me, I wouldn't know because it's about 20 years since I did a team time trial, but I'm told it's one of the most painful disciplines going. Is that right?
I would agree with that. Yeah, I don't know, something about it, you can just push yourself so much more when you're with your teammates and you don't want to let your team down. So yeah, it's all about finding your limits in that, the discipline.
Now, Lee, you've only just joined the team. I did a bit of checking up on you earlier, and you were in 2014, correct me if I'm wrong, you were Canadian road time trial and crit champion. That's a bit greedy, isn't it? Any favourites out of the three?
My favourite, I'd have to pick the road race. I love road racing. I love when races come down to sprints, that kind of thing. But from that year, I was really proud of the time trial championship, because every year I worked so hard on improving on that weakness, and then it was really satisfying to be time trial champion of Canada.
I guess you were in the States, were you, with Optum for the last few years? Yeah. So this is probably going to be quite an eye-opener, but I think you have actually raced in Europe before, haven't you?
Yeah, so I do have some experience racing here with the national team, and the last couple of years Optum has been able to come over for a few trips. So I'm not totally new and know a little bit what to expect, but I'm also really excited to get to do some new races this year, like the early classics and things like the Giro I've never ridden. So I'm quite excited for that.
May have escaped your attention, but apparently there's an Olympics on this year. Any chance of you going to that, do you think?
Yeah, that's really my biggest goal of the season, and it has been the last few years. And I think if I feel good right now, and if I race well in the spring with the team and show that I'm one of the best riders, then you'll see me in Rio.
Let's hope so. You won't see me in Rio. We don't get invited. Molly, you had a very interesting year last year because you were riding for Steph Wyman's Matrix team, the British team, and then in the middle of the season, out of the blue, unless it was not out of the blue, you tell me, out of the blue, Liv Planter said, come and ride for us. That must have been a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, definitely. The first part of the season was really good, actually, with Matrix, and I did better than maybe I thought I would. And yeah, halfway through the season, I went home for a bit of a rest. I was living in Belgium at the time, and I get a phone call from Steph saying that the DS of Liv Planter wanted to sign me, and yeah, it all happened very quickly from there.
How long did you hesitate before saying yes, please?
I think 0.1 seconds.
Okay, give or take.
Yeah.
Roughly. Any races you did last season that were particularly memorable?
We actually did all the big classics of Matrix, which was really good. The standout one was probably Flanders for me, just such a spectacle, such a massive event. Getting Bevelgem for the weather was also quite an experience. It's just, yeah, it's worlds away from racing domestically as well, so pretty much every race you go to is a new experience for you.
And where are you based? Are you based in Holland or not?
No, I actually live in Girona now, and over the winter I've been there for the whole of the training period, but in the season, I'll split my time between Holland and Girona.
Basically, in Girona, you can't go more than 100 yards without bumping into a pro cyclist. It's my experience. It's pretty much it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit like that. It's, on the rides, it's really nice. It's cyclists everywhere, pros everywhere. It feels like a really good environment for it. And you can't go to the supermarket in your pyjamas, though, because you will see someone you know.
And who does the best coffee in Girona?
La Fabrica has to do the best, yeah. And it's apparently owned by a Canadian, I've learned. So
that's why it's so good.
Yeah, that's why it's so good.
Yeah, Amber, she's very good. And they have good magazines lying around in La Fabrica as well. I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, I've seen actually there's Rouleur, which is my favourite.
Really?
That's there. So my dad is very happy about that. I buy him every year a subscription for Christmas. That's not a lie, that's the truth.
That's fantastic. There'll be that €20 I'll be giving you as soon as we're finished. So how much longer are you here for, and then where do you go next?
We've actually only got one more day left. It's been a 10-day camp, so a nice length, but not too long, which is good. And then we only have a week and a half before we head to Qatar.
Yeah, less than a week. Yeah. And then straight into racing.
So you need to practice your echelons, I'm guessing.
Yes, we've been practicing this week.
We've done our lead out practice, and it has been windy here, so it's been ideal actually.
Leah, looking at your palmares, I figure you're quite a handy sprinter, is that right?
That's definitely my strength.
And what about you, Molly? What's your strength?
I consider myself an all-rounder in terms of the type of racing. I like, yeah, quite a hard course, but in more of a classic style than, you know, like the mountains of the Giro. I think maybe I haven't learnt yet exactly what kind of rider I am, but yeah, over this year, maybe I'll learn a bit more about that.
Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's Leah Kirschman and Molly Weaver talking to Ian Cleverly in Calpe. Now, in issue 60, Andy, you've written a nice piece about Fabian Cancellara. Of course, it's his last season in the pro ranks. And it struck me that you sort of nailed it in the first paragraph when you say that Fabian is a class rider. Class is what sort of makes him stand out, really, isn't it?
Well, firstly, it's kind of the fact, it's his generosity of strength that he's never seemed to shirk a turn on the front, even when that leads to his own kind of defeat sometimes. It's the way he conducts himself, both off the bike and on the bike. I didn't really get a chance to mention it so much in the feature because there's only so much space, but he was actually a great helper to Sastre and the Schlecks in their CSC years. And that is pretty rare for a champion to be winning classics, world champs, and in the middle, giving his all for 3 weeks in a Grand Tour. There's numerous things. It's very easy to lose that class. I mean, frankly, I would say Peter Sagan is a very classy bike rider, a classy man. The podium bum-pinching thing is still on my mind, but he's still young anyway. Whereas Cancellara, I can't imagine him pinching some woman's bum on the podium. It's just not becoming.
A lot of people, of course, will remember that video of him descending in the Tour of 2009, Stage 7, I think, wasn't it, where he's trying to get back on the pack. And it's one of those things where you, after about 20 seconds, you think, well, I'd be dead by then. And then a couple of yards later, it's, yep, that's me over the edge again. You know, it's extraordinary bike handling skill.
It's not even that I'd be dead, but I would be not nearly as fluid. I'll be so tense and ragged and knees out, and he just goes with the bike, and it seems effortless, which is very envy inducing, I think.
Although we have to remember, of course, that in the Olympic road race, he did manage to stack it in Richmond Park. There's something ironic about one of the greatest bike handlers in the peloton coming to grief on a relatively simple roundabout.
I think they call it Cancellara Corner now.
Yeah, it's the one up by Richmond Gate, if anyone's visiting Richmond Park and doesn't know that.
That's the other thing about class. Like, he's had his fair share of falls and bad luck, but he's always been very consistent. He always seems to bounce back. And if he's had a bad season, which is never that bad of him anyway in the whole scheme of things, he will then win a big race the next year, which is why his last season, after lots of misfortune last season, his final one, he's probably going to win something big, you'd think.
Yeah, when I spoke to him, he was saying that he was, you know, really looking forward to this season because every race was going to be his last attempt at that race, so he may as well go for it. Do you think he's got some big targets?
Yeah, he seems to be doing something a little bit different by entering the Giro off the classics firstly to win there and get the Maglia Rosa. As for the Cobble Classics, I guess for those races, you've always got to race them like it'll be the last time. They're so cut and thrust, so fiercely fought, that I don't think there'll be that much of a difference. I think he'll be 35 by the time they roll around. It'll be very interesting to see if age has blunted him significantly, and if so, how much. Because we've seen, I think the last two monuments he won were Roubaix 2014 and Flanders 2013. And both of those were quite different, more tactical. I think he was outfoxing other riders in a breakaway sprint finish.
It's going to be a really interesting season to watch, actually, isn't it? So the competition, Andy,
yes.
In Ian's absence, have you got the details of the competition from 59 and for this edition?
Yes. Well, firstly, the question in the 59 podcast, it came from Martin Proctor's article about the Ruler Awards at the Classic. And the question was, what won one-day race of the year? The answer was Paris-Roubaix.
Yep.
And the winner is Sean Daly, who receives a Sean Kelly signed copy of issue 57, which had King Kelly as one of the main features.
And very appropriate for Paris-Roubaix as well.
Indeed. Well done, Sean. The question for this podcast then, relating to the fantastic Theatre of Pain feature written by Paul Maunder and photographed by Marshall Capel. What year did the Mer de Huy first appear in the route of La Flèche Wallonne?
Okay, the year the Mer de Huy first appeared in the Flèche Wallonne.
The prize is one of our Icon t-shirts, so you can choose between a Maltini one, a Fima one, or a Brooklyn-inspired one.
Great, and how do people enter?
To enter, you just see the podcast page on ruler.cc and place your answer there.
Okay, that's it from this podcast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Ian Parkinson. Thanks to Andy McGrath. Go safe out there, and we'll talk next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.